Hello everyone, my name is Phil Blancato. I am CEO and President of Latimer Thalmann Asset Management, a division of Advisor Group. Today is April the 8th, 2020. Welcome to our weekly update call as what's going on in the marketplace, the overall economy, and expectations for the weeks ahead. Well, certainly these are unprecedented times. When you think about the roller coaster ride we've been on for the past more or less 2 months now, it really is amazing how much has happened in such a short amount of time. Can you believe we're now more than 50% off the lows of early March? The S&P 500 has rebounded back all the way to 2749 when it actually touched 2300 just a few weeks ago. We were down 34% at the very bottom and now down just past 15% as of today's close. There's a couple reasons why the market has reacted the way it has. There is no doubt that there's some euphoria in the marketplace. Maybe we should start there. When you look at some of the data coming out of places like Italy, and you analyze the fact that they have finally bent the curve, Italy reported new cases of just 3,039 people yesterday, and just a week ago, it was 4,053, so a 25% decline. Spain reported 5,267 cases, but yesterday, and just a week ago, it was 7,967, a 33% decline. When you look at the death rate in both countries, both in Italy down over 27% in the last week, and Spain down over 6% in the last week. When you start to think about the impact of a slower curve, when you start to ask yourself, have we actually begun to bend the curve? Certainly what matters in the United States is incredibly important to all of us on a personal level and, of course, an economic level. Well, it's time to sit back and think, are we finally there? When we start to do the analysis, there's a very good possibility in the city that I live and work, New York City, we are actually beginning to have great success in bending the curve. The rate of people who are entering hospitals in New York City is on decline by almost 5% now. You're seeing the number of people who are becoming significantly ill in need of intensive care also going down. And in fact, the same holds true for New Jersey. When we chart out the current rate of change, now it's early and it's just beginning, but there's a very good possibility that we've peaked. Also on the national level, which is greatly influenced by the New York level, is also showing a reduction. So believe it or not, there is a very good possibility as we chart the path of the virus that not only New Jersey peaked today is the chart path, but if we look forward, New York should peak tomorrow. And right behind it, there is a number of very large states who have had very large impacts that will begin to peak. So it stands to reason that the market has reacted positively. Whether it's the data coming out of Europe, even Great Britain has begun to show improvement, or the data in the United States, which is beginning to show significant improvement, the two unknowns of the market, the two things that the market needed to know is, one, how many people have the virus and how fast it's spreading, and two, is there something we can do about it from an antibody or antivirus? We're certainly the unknown number one. What we were focused on first is now known. For those of you who may have listened to prior calls, I talked a lot about how it's critical for the market to get to a place where it can understand the speed of the spread. And once we know that, then we can put that into context as what's happened in other times in history. And in fact, when we look back at other viruses that have taken place, there's no doubt that this is starting to look very similar to other viruses. Look at it in this context, that there's four stages to the spread, control, and reduction of a virus. In stage one, you have exponential spread. We've already seen that. Globally and domestically, we have beginning to see peaks around the world. And there's no doubt that whether it's in Europe, the beginnings of it here, or in Asia, there's definitely a significant improvement. And last night, just in Wuhan, China, where this all began, they actually opened the city back up and diminishing significantly the social distancing requirements. So stage one, that exponential spread, looks like it's happened. Moving on to stage two is where the growth of the people getting infected is beginning to slow down. And in fact, we're seeing that profoundly in Europe, and that we're seeing the number of people getting the virus go down significantly. Stage three, the fatality rate drops. The fatality rate is a lagging indicator. First, the number of people who get sick go down, and then second, the number of people who die go down. So first, the growth of it, forgive me. Second, the number of people getting infected begins to go down. Third, the number of fatalities begin to go down. And then fourth, we get to a point where we're actually reducing the total amount of infections down to near zero and the total amount of death rate down to zero. So when thinking of things in that four-stage concept, China is already in stage four. Italy is in stage three. We are in stage two, and no one really is left in stage one except for maybe Africa, but that's just beginning in a very different context since they have a much warmer climate. Very optimistic about where the disease is at right now and the spread of it, arguing that we've met our peak, which is why the market has reacted so euphorically recently. You look at the S&P 500, when it finished the year down 20%, we've taken out another, finished a quarter down 20%. We've improved by just another 5% in the few days of April here. So there's no doubt that there's some euphoria in the marketplace. The second component of this, as we begin to look at the data, is the United States going to fall into a recession? And that's one of the hardest parts about this, because the belief is that, in my opinion, this isn't really a recession. In fact, it's unfair to almost call it a recession. And the reason why is that this is a biological event having an economic impact. And in that context, this becomes an event-driven recession. There are three types of recession. There's a structural recession, meaning we go to a slow grind down, we have a bubble in the marketplace like 2008, and suddenly we go into a long drawn-out recession. We have a cyclical one. Every 5 to 8 years, generally we get a recession just because of the ebbs and flows of the business cycle. Business is going out of favor, we slow down. And then we have an event-driven recession, like this one. This is an event-driven recession, which the good news is they tend to be the shortest recessions, less than 9 months long, and they tend to have the quickest recovery period, just about 15 months. So in that mindset, if this is a event-driven recession, and we're beginning to slow the curve, the next piece we have to understand is, where are we at economically, and can we rebound like we have historically? Well, before I go into all the economic data, the first point I want to bring out is, when we think about economics that really matter, it really comes down to you, the consumer. What's your sentiment? How confident are you? How much believability do you have in the current economy, your ability to sustain yourself, and can you feed your families or enjoy the lifestyle that you'd want? Well, one of the things that came out just recently was consumer confidence. And I'm going to take a different approach than most. There was a concern that consumer confidence had fallen too much. And I argue the other side. I was very impressed by the level of consumer confidence and consumer sentiment that just came out a few days ago. And the reason why I was so impressed with it was because we expected the rate to fall down significantly. And while the numbers for both of them were down, we saw traditional consumer sentiment come down to 89 in the month of March. We saw consumer confidence, which they're very similar, just two different surveys, come down to 120. But you see, 89 on sentiment or 120 on confidence are still much higher than historical averages. And in fact, just off all-time highs. So the first reading, when we were in this shock and awe moment of the marketplace, actually you, the consumer, saw this and didn't overreact, didn't panic. That's a great sign to say that if the consumer going into this was in good shape, and now we have a situation where economically we're under great stress, but the confidence level remains high, what that will do is create pent-up demand on the other side of this event. Again, an event driven in recession. So let's focus on that for a minute. If the consumer stays strong, and in fact retail sales, which was down for the month of February, and we're expecting the March number pretty soon, but yet online sales were up almost a full point, tells me that embedded in this, there lies opportunity. Think about the areas of the economy that are doing well, like the technology area, doing very well. Think about consumer staples. You go into Costco and buy goods and services, doing very well. So it's not to say the entire economy is shuttered down. There is no doubt the leisure, tourism, restaurant, hospitality industry is under great pressure. And in the economics of that, we are great concerns. We are now saw in the last 2 weeks alone, 10 million people applied for unemployment benefits. That's the greatest number in American history, times five. I mean, we've seen numbers that we've never seen before. The most anyone ever applied for unemployment benefits was back in the 80s, and that was 600,000 in 1 week. We've added 10 million in 2 weeks. So you can imagine it's a pretty catastrophic number. But the first data point I'd draw is consumer confidence versus some optimism. There are reasons to be concerned. The labor market, as I just mentioned, is of great concern. We're watching our manufacturing sector, and we're watching our consumer services sector. The services sector is much more important to the overall economy, both heading into significant contraction mode. So we are going to see great pressure on the overall economy. The GDP, our gross domestic product for the second quarter, could be as low as 34%. That's negative 34%. We've never seen that number before. Add to it, we could see unemployment, the number of people unemployed, reach 32% of the working population. That could be in excess of 20 million people. There's been some projections as high as 47 million people. Those are catastrophic, depressionary-like numbers on a percentage basis. They are extremely concerning. But why I bear some optimism is because when you think of what caused this, this was a forced economic shutdown. And while I do expect catastrophic GDP numbers, earnings, how much companies earn, are going to be terrible going into this. We're going to see negative earnings growth of anywhere from 5 to negative 15%. We're looking at the total revenue of the United States, which is around $23, $24 million, losing $4 to $5 million of our total revenue. Really horrific numbers. But there is something on our side. Because this was event-driven, what the federal government decided to do was come in and be the backstop in the fact that not only did they force this shutdown, but on the other side of this, they've created an environment where they could actually limit the impact by creating great amount of liquidity. It's critical to understand that that is a major factor in all this. So the federal government has come in and done a number of things. First off, when it comes to general unemployment benefits, depending on what state somebody lives in, let's say the average worker in the United States earns about $1,000 a week. Based on state benefits, that number can vary between $400 to $600. Well, the federal government has come in and supplemented that money to the tune of an additional $600. And in some cases, that could be for the next 3 months. So in other words, for the average person who is making $1,000 a week, they're going to get in combined benefits just about $1,000 or more benefits. And that's going to continue for at least the next 3 months. So that was step one to supporting the consumer, keeping that sentiment high and preparing us for when we get into stage four of no virus, no very low limited new infections, very low number of deaths, so that the consumer can then get to work and begin to spend again. So that's part one. Part two in the CARES Act was specifically designed to help businesses that have less than 500 people by giving them a forgivable loan, saying to them, what's your total rent? What's your salary cost for your employees? How much does it cost you to run your business? And basically handing them that amount of money in the form of a forgivable loan, assuming they keep their business open, keep their folks employed, and continue as business as usual as much as possible, especially if they're in a required industry. So in two power punches, one for the consumer and the other one for small businesses, the Federal Reserve has come into the rescue. That's on top of all the things we've already heard about, which is the numerous programs created by the federal government to create liquidity in the bond market, meaning being the buyer of last resort and the lender of last resort, and on top of supporting municipalities at the local level and large corporations that might need additional money to keep them liquid. With the idea being the federal government and the Federal Reserve has by basically created a bridge to the other side of this event, dropping interest rates to near zero, letting companies borrow money at the lowest cost in arguably history, allowing companies to refinance with the federal government, allowing companies to borrow money from the federal government, going in and printing dollars to be able to make sure the dollars are not short supply. All these things create, make the system work efficiently. And that's the big difference between this and 2008. When in 2008, so much of it was about the freezing up of our financial system, this time the financial system is working really pretty well. And that's the big difference than last time. I wouldn't say the same for Europe. Europe is still struggling. While Europe's number of cases improving, they haven't yet supported their economy the way we have. So I think you should take some pride in the fact that the U.S. economy has, U.S. federal government has stepped up and prepared us to be on the other side of this event. It's a critical component to this. So when you think about what the federal government has done, not only is it creating liquidity, not only is it creating lending programs, not only is it giving away money, it's put itself in the position to really be the pillar of the economy that the consumer once was, at least temporarily until we get to the other side of this. that's a very exciting aspect, because remember, for you, the consumer, if we can keep the consumer afloat, on the other side of this event, you're looking at some of the lowest interest rates in your lifetime, being able to refinance your debt, as many people already have. You're looking at energy prices, which are a big part of your monthly spend, being some of the lowest you've seen in years. I paid $1.89 this weekend for gasoline, and doggone it, had I gone to Costco, I would have paid $1.82 for regular gasoline. So we're watching that be a significant stimulus. Now, don't get me wrong, the amount of gasoline consumption we use is down by 20%. That's the lowest drop, arguably, in history. So there's no doubt you're using less gas because you're not going anywhere in most cases. But the amount you're going to pay on the other side of that is a critical component of it. Think about what you're going to spend on your goods and services, all at significantly lower prices. You know, so I look at some of this and I realize that there is an opportunity for you, the consumer, to show great strength on the other side of this, whether it's in the form of energy, low interest rates, support by the federal government. And then on top of that, there's a good chance the job that was out there before, most of them, certainly not all of them, will be there again on the other side of this. So reason for optimism was the strength of the U.S. economy, supported by the federal government, really represented by the consumer, should still be there on the other side of this, which gets us into this dialogue of, will we have a V-shaped recovery or will we have sort of a U-shaped recovery? Still too early to understand that aspect of it. And the reason why is the second unknown. We've talked a lot about the first unknown, that the virus is now under control, arguably, and certainly every day we think that's going to be more the case. The spread is now known. The economy was strong going in. The federal government has supported it. What's lacking is we still don't know how we stop it. We think we can slow it down, and that should allow us to reopen the economy. But how do we stop it? So let's first talk about reopening the economy. And that squarely comes down to, when you look at the modeling that was put in place by well, there's a number of different models, but the most popular is that of the University of Washington. There is real change in how we're looking at that model. So the forecasting mechanism used by the federal government, and there are a number of different ones, really is suggesting that we were expecting a much higher infection rate and we were expecting a much higher death rate. Now, as of right now, that's not happening. In fact, we're looking at a 30% reduction in the original model. Well, that's critically important. And the reason why that's so critically important is because if, in fact, we're having a 30% reduction in the overall original model, and we actually see a speed up potentially in the number of people who are no longer being infected, and more importantly, folks who are not having to be on ventilators, not being in critical condition, or even more so, not passing away from this terrible disease, then we have a very different scenario when we reopen up the economy. Because the original projections were really all about getting up and going again by July. Now, I know there was this expectation that we'd begin here in early May, but that's only the beginning of it, fully up and running by July. Well, if in fact we're able to reduce the infectious rate and the mortality rate by up to 30%, that it comes in significantly better, then all of a sudden we're able to reduce the timeline to get the economy up and running. So in fact, maybe it's not July, but actually backs up to June or even late May to be fully up and running again. That's a critical component of this. So that's why understanding the spread of the disease is so important, and reevaluating the model as to when we can reopen the economy is top of the agenda right now. Secondarily to that is, if we in fact get a significant reduction in the viruses, other than people affected by the virus, and we, more importantly, can track China, and that Wuhan just opened up again last night, so there really is a path to success here, which Italy is on. When I look to a country like Germany that is beginning to lay out the process of opening up, there is a multiple-step solution to this. Now, when we think about how we would reopen the economy, it comes down to, one, do we have enough testing in place to be able to test everyone who wants to go back to work and know who's sick on an ongoing basis? One of the most exciting aspects of new technology that's coming out is Abbott Labs is a company that has already in most offices a piece of equipment that looks about the size of a toaster that can test you and let you know if you have the virus within 5 minutes and let you know within 15 minutes if you don't. It's really very exciting. So add one more to that. There's another company called Becton Dickinson that's actually coming up with a system where you can maybe even test yourself at home. And one more on top of that, Henry Schein is another company that's also creating an at-home quick test kit that would allow us to really be able to gauge when we're sick. Why that's so important is we would then have the opportunity to really know who is sick as we reopen the economy and then isolate targeted in a rifle approach rather than a shotgun approach as to not a broad brush, but really targeted as to who has the disease and being able to keep them home and knowing from it in advance rather than having to lock down the whole economy. Critical first step is expanding the testing, and that's why we are so fired up about the idea that we are having real short, fast testing come to market on a rapid basis. The second step is, what is the acceptable spread? So in other words, if we're going to open up the economy, what percent of the spread and what number of people, where China's adding just less than 100 people a week, in fact, that had no new cases yesterday and no deaths yesterday from it, is that the right spread for us? What's the acceptable spread to which we'd all have to agree upon to reopen the economy and get comfortable with some measure of social distancing? It's not that social distancing is just going to go away. We're just going to have to keep washing our hands and not touching our face and probably wear masks, but be able to get back to work. Then the third step is, can we protect the vulnerable? Can we protect the folks who have a pre-existing condition or might be elderly who we have to make sure they're not exposed in any way to the virus? What's the steps around that? Can we let younger people get back to work who either have the antibodies, have already had the virus, or are not as susceptible to serious ill? Then can we gradually start to turn on the non-essential businesses, meaning what businesses like restaurants and cafes and so on get turned on with some mandates about how we still separate? And then finally, what private industries can be turned on that could go back to work but still have some measure of social distancing? So that plugs right into how we open it up. And here's the critical piece. What are we going to do about solving it from a medical front? Well, I think it's really exciting to spend a few minutes on what's going on medically. Right now, there's 140 experimental drugs and vaccines on the coronavirus in development worldwide. There's 11 already in clinical trials. Believe it or not, if you look at repurposed drugs and new drugs coming to marketplace, there are 254 clinical trials going on around the globe. Based on Phil Stoffels, who's the chief scientist for Johnson & Johnson, has come out publicly and said, and he's the one that has the newest antivirus that we think could be available by early January for global distribution, which basically eliminates the disease. It's an antivirus, not an antibody. But he's come out and said, we have never gone so fast with so many resources in such a short amount of time. There is a global effort to find antibodies and antiviruses. That's a critical component about them. And let's separate them for a minute, because depending on which company you're talking about, they're both very much in play. So J&J has come out and said they have an antivirus that they should have up and running here by January for global distribution. And that's very exciting because they partnered with the administration to invest a significant amount of money to bring their antivirus and begin testing it here in the next few weeks. The WTO is actually testing four different current medicines, one of them being the malaria drug, around the world, repurposing existing drugs to see if any of those could get people off of ventilators. And that's a clinical trial that they started already a week and a half ago. Abbott Labs, I already mentioned, has this very exciting ability to test people in a short amount of time. Henry Schein is the company that's going to have a finger prick that can tell you in 15 minutes at your house if, in fact, you have an antibody or sick at that point. And they can actually deliver hundreds of thousands of those by right now. And they should be able to have their distribution in the marketplace today. They're bringing them to market as we speak. One of my favorite points is Jacob Glanville. He's the CEO of Distribution Bio. Has basically come out and said, we have it. They have found an antibody that can actually come out and cure people. And it'll give you 8 to 10 weeks of resistance to the disease. It puts an antibody in your body, and in 20 minutes time, you begin to develop antibodies that'll fight off the virus and cure you until you can get to an antivirus. Remember, antibodies and antiviruses are different. That has actually been developed and been handed off to the Military Institute to test it and the Bill Gates Foundation. So it's really very exciting that they have come out and said, we have the cure. These are the same folks that were very involved in the Ebola vaccine and believe that they found it. Add to that, Regeneron is another company that has said they have an antibody right now. They're willing to bring it to market for first line folks that are sick, and more importantly, first line hospital workers, and be able to test them also in early April. So two companies saying they have it and begin clinical trials immediately. Regeneron has an existing drug called Kevzara they're willing to repurpose. And we really go on and on from here. Novavax has an antibody they just announced yesterday. They're going to testing as well. The University of Pittsburgh is going to testing as well. They have a skin patch. It looks like a little clear patch that you put on your skin and puts an antibody into your body in short time and helps your body develop antibodies against the virus. That's also being backed up by the Gates Foundation. There's been lots of information around the malaria drug about numerous people saying it's working. So far, it's anecdotal evidence that it is working, but certainly being tested, and we'll have more and more evidence as we go on. And probably the most exciting, well, don't forget about Moderna. That's one we mentioned in the past that's already in clinical trials. And on the 28th of April, we'll have the first real results of whether or not their antivirus is working. Add to that, Inovio Pharmaceuticals is one I mentioned a few weeks back. They have now begun testing and just in the last 2 days enrolling 40 people in Philadelphia and Kansas City with their antivirus. So antibodies and antiviruses both going full steam ahead. And probably my fun favorite story is one by a company called British American Tobacco, symbol BAT. They're actually taking the antivirus and infusing it into a plant, a tobacco plant. That tobacco plant actually takes on the virus and changes it, kind of hijacks it and turns around and changes the makeup of the virus so that it becomes an antibody. We then would grind up the plant, turn it into a pill, and you would take a natural fighter, a natural antibody, against the virus in a form of a plant. So putting it in a tobacco plant and turning it into a medicine that could actually bring down the impact of the virus. That's in testing as well. Tobacco plants grow very quickly, and they actually believe they can have millions of doses to market by June. So my point is, of the 140 different treatments that are around the globe, all we need to get that second unknown figured out is to one of these to actually work. Naturally, the heat of the summer is going to make the droplets from our saliva and our bodies is going to carry less in the hot weather. They expand more and fall faster. The virus will also dry on surfaces. So much of this comes from touching it on a surface and then rubbing your face. So as those two diminish and we get outside more with social distancing, the virus will automatically go down like all viruses do when it comes to summertime. But add to that, the social distancing is working, and we're seeing it in the number of cases around the globe coming down. So I guess I'd wrap up by saying there is no doubt that we are in for some volatile times. The market has reacted with positive volatility the last few days. We've had a real exciting bounce off the bottom. You see, people buy stocks when they get cheap, and the stock market had gotten very inexpensive. Some very quality names have become very inexpensive, and for that reason, the stock market bounced back. But the headlines have also been pretty good. The bending of the curve in Europe, the beginning of the bending of the curve here, has put some euphoria back into the marketplace. But let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. Over the next few weeks here, there's going to be a lot more data around really terrible economic numbers from continued rise in unemployment, really terrible earnings. Some of the data around the virus is going to be lumpy. There will still be some bad days ahead as expectations go. The death rate's going to get higher before it goes lower, so that's going to be a concern. So it's not to say we're out of all the negative headlines, and for that reason, the market's going to continue to trade in these ranges. But look at the market in this context. Phase one is that shock and awe, where the market significantly sold off, and we saw the real wild panic selling going on in the marketplace for a number of days there. We're out of phase one. We're now in phase two, which is the market will trade sideways looking for a bottom, looking for a reason to stop selling off, begin to build a bottom and grind higher. That phase two should come to fruition really when we have a better understanding of what's going on with the virus. Are we at acceptable rate of spread? Are there any medical reasons to think we're past it? And is the economy opening up? Are we beginning to generate revenue? Therein lies we'll get out of phase two. And there's phase three, grinding higher and getting higher. There's no doubt that will happen once we have control of the virus and you'll see economic growth really begin to expand. But remember, let history be your guide. Since 1928, there's been 14 recessions and 21 bear markets. Equity markets never fail to regain their peak,
Never. And we've got an 8% rate of return going all the way back to when we looked and started the markets back in the early 1900s. We need about an 8% rate of return to get back to where we were just a few months ago. So we're following history as a guide. There is no doubt that this is not unlike times in our past. So I think you should take some comfort that anytime we've had profound market sell-offs, we get usually a bounce back to some level of normalcy. That's already happened. Add to it that history as a guide tells us it's not unlikely, not unusual for us to be 12 months from now to 24 months from now, either up or doubly up from where we were. Meaning, if you look at other times in our history when markets have sold off, not only has it always recovered, but usually fast sell-offs mean fast rebound. As I mentioned earlier, event-driven recessions tend to be the shortest and those that rebound the fastest. So stay away from the headlines because they can be somewhat damaging. Focus on the data about where we are economically, which it's going to look bad, but at the end, the federal government's going to help us get through this, and we were in good shape going in. Remember that the consumer stimulated by low gas prices, low interest rates, and the access to capital, which is being made available to them, and with the strength of the American economy, backed by the strength of all of us doing our social distancing and the medical industry coming to bear with lots of different options, we think we're going to be out of this sooner rather than later. Most importantly, stay safe. Stay home. Wash your hands. Don't touch your face. And hopefully in a short amount of time, we're talking about markets getting back to where we were and less about how bad it got. Thank you very much, everybody. Look forward to speaking to you again next week. Have a wonderful weekend. For those of you celebrating the holidays weekend, this weekend, have a great holiday weekend as well. Thank you and take care.